I'd like to clarify one thing. I'm not one of the stage decorations that you'll win. God, this has got to be the biggest drunk tank in the world. A hell of a deal this is. I'd first of all like to thank the committee and Ray for phoning me and inviting me down here. It's been an honor. It's a privilege to me. I lost all my rights when I came to this fellowship. Everything that happens and everything I do and every place I go is a privilege. Everything I treasure today is a privilege. I admire all these people who still have a lot of rights. Go get drunk and we'll find out how many bloody rights you got. You know, I'd like to thank Ross for picking me up at the airport. Doug and I, a chap who came down with me, and Doug is very active in service in my area. And I'd like to really compliment this committee and this convention and their 50 years just for the way it's run, for the way it's set up, for the whole complete structure of this convention and what it represents, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling in this great fellowship of ours from South Africa to the Yukon. And we're very privileged. It's not the same wherever you go. I hear people say that, but that's not quite true. I have a big book here with me, and I'll be referring to this a lot tonight. It's a cheap book. It doesn't cost a lot. I believe it's going to catch on one day in our fellowship. I read 8 pages of this book 365 days a year. There's one story I read every Friday 52 times a year, which is Freedom from Bondage. And I read this here and my 12 and 12. And I don't own the 12 by 12. That's a piece of timber. This talks about a 12 and 12. And they go hand in hand. I've not found it necessary to take a drink for 20 days, 6 months, and 33 years. And that only proves 2 things to me. One is that Alcoholics Anonymous has passed the experimental stages. It's here to stay. And this thing was designed by drunks for drunks, and if we lose sight of that, we're in one hell of a pile of trouble. I was in New Zealand last year and then 2 years prior to that. And in the South Island, in the meetings that I was at, they wouldn't even allow the big book at a meeting. Outdated. I started quoting the book and I was asked to sit down. And like a lot of people say, oh, I don't believe that. Well, go there. I don't ask anyone to believe me. It's just things are different. You know, we're very fortunate here in all we have. I just came back a few weeks ago from a long holiday in Portugal. And we were in the Algarve, my wife and I. I've seen the triangle and the circle in the book, so I phoned up. This man's voice answered the phone and I said, I'm from Vancouver, British Columbia. That didn't impress him. And I said, I'm looking for an AA meeting. He said, no AA here, too much wine. He said, phone Farrell. And there is no meetings there. So when they say in this book, we stay sober under all conditions, you'll find out a lot of these conditions once you get out of your own backyard, that little comfortable cocoon that you're in. My name is Lou Pendemore, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I say that because that was something that my sponsor, who died a few years ago, and Tyler, instilled in me. He said, if you notice some of the interesting things in this book, he said, one is the word text. And for people who have attended school, what were textbooks used for? To study. In this book it says, we beg of you to study this book. It doesn't say read it. So this is our basic text. And in the preface, in the beginning of this book, it says this is how 150,000 alcoholics have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. We hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. Further on, it says, why shouldn't we be happy? We have recovered. Chapter 5 says, those who do not recover. And that's unquote. But what is important, it says to show other people precisely how we have recovered. It doesn't say to tell them. I'd rather see a sermon than to hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely show the way. It says, I can soon learn how to do it if you let me see it done. But your tongue too fast in action and your hands too fast may run. All the lectures you deliver may be very wise and true, but there's no mistake or understanding in how you live and what you do. And that's what this thing's all about. There's only one way that I could get from the Salvation Army mission on the Skid Row of Vancouver to Sacramento, California. And that's through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you care to take the time to look up the word grace in the dictionary, it says an unearned favor. God's been so good to me. So good to me. And I hope I always remember maybe to think of you more than me, because in the book it says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all our problems. It doesn't say our financial problems or sex problems. It says it's the root of all our problems. So are we thinking of other people? You know, it's like the old man, the fellow was sitting on a bus one day, and it was on Valentine's Day, around that period. And he had a beautiful arrangement of flowers in his lap. And a young fellow got on and sat down beside him, and he had a card. He looked at the old man, and he said, boy, he said, somebody's going to get a nice Valentine's gift. And he said, yep. And he said to the young fellow, he said, you have a girlfriend? He said, yes, I do. And he said, I'm taking her this card. He said, that's all I can afford to give her this year. The old man said, that's good. A few moments later, the old man reached up and pulled the cord on the bus to get off. As he went to get off, he put the beautiful arrangement of flowers in this young man's lap, and he said, give these to your girlfriend. My wife would like that. And as the bus pulled into the curb, the young man watched as the old gentleman got off and walked through the gates into a cemetery. I hope I always have that type of remembrance. I was listening to Kenna today and her story, and our speaker last night, and David. I was in David's home, his third year sober. And I really treasure him and Gracie. I don't see them a lot today, but that doesn't mean I can't treasure. I go back to a number of things. I hear a lot of things from this podium, and I have searched diligently in our book, and I can't find it. 90 meetings in 90 days, or we'll return your misery. I have no idea where it come from, but it's repeated a lot. I didn't know it was a 90-day program. It is for a lot of people. I find a piece in our book where it says, our primary purpose is to stay sober, not to get sober. And so these are the things I look at today. I hear so many things that they don't make a lot of sense to me, and they don't have to. But I think I'd owe it to that new guy or new gal to tell them precisely what's in this book, and to tell them precisely how this thing all came about, and to get to know a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I hear people say that alcoholics have above average intelligence. I've only heard that at AA meetings. I have spoken at AA conventions from Pretoria in South Africa to Dawson City in the Yukon. And I have never been at an AA convention where the theme is the keen alcoholic mind. See, the unfortunate thing about a drunk is that he always wants to be a part of the show. He sees what you're doing, yet he doesn't see. He hears what you said, but he didn't hear it. And it's too bad. It's like the guy that's drunk, he made this kite, and he never put no tail on the end of it. And he was trying to fly this thing. And he'd throw it up in the air and run like hell, and it'd go about 20 feet and pile right into the ground. And he'd throw it up again, and it'd go about 20 feet and pile into the ground. And he did this about 3 times, and his wife must have been an Al-Anon member. She looked out the door, and she said, you bloody dummy, you need more tail. He said, make up your mind. Last night you told me to go fly a kite. So, we have a very unique ability to never learn anything from what we did yesterday. It's like the two hunters in Ontario. They flew into this lake, And when the pilot let him off, he said, "Now remember," he said, "two moose is all we can take out of here." He said, "I'll be back and get you next Tuesday." So he come back Tuesday and he come up to the dock, and here they are, and they got three moose. He said, "I told you, we can't get out of here with this size of an airplane with three moose and you two and all your gear in it." They said, "Look, we heard that from the pilot last year, and we gave him $500, and he took our three moose out." So this guy went for it. He took their money, loaded their moose, loaded them and all their gear, and he went down the lake, and off of the lake the plane went and cleared the trees, and they went about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and they crashed. When they all come to, one hunter said, the other said, "Where are we?" He said, 1,000 yards further than we got last year. And and that's the story of my life. You know, people say, you know, about old timers, it's easy. Don't drink, don't die. I've stayed here for 33 years in case you ever get a pension plan. I want all my benefits. I was born on the east coast of Canada, right on the border of the state of Maine. 63 years ago. The Bible says the wise men come from the east, and I'm wise enough to stay the hell out west, I'll tell you that. Where I come from, there wasn't a lot of wisdom, I'll tell you that. I think they realize that no matter where the hell you come from, or they wouldn't have the Serenity Prayer where it says we pray for wisdom. We like to pretend that we're really smart. Really smart. But it says we tell in a general way what we drank like, or what we were like, what happened to what we're like now. It doesn't say what we drank like. What was I like when I drank? And I said earlier today, I was an impulsive, compulsive, repulsive drunk. And if you look up those three words, that saves me from going into one of these drink-by-drink tours. I can spend 3/4 of an hour here on my drinking and 15 minutes since I sobered up. But I think the new people that are here today wants to know how I stay sober, not how I drank. And I believe equally as much, if I want to know anything about drinking, I better talk to a person who just came here this week. So it says in a general way what I was like. I was taken away from my real mother. She was a gorgeous woman. I got to see her when I was about 11, but she looked just like Olivia de Havilland. She could have been her twin sister. She wore the floppy hats. She was gorgeous. And she had a little hotel that she looked after in a railroad divisional town. She supplied the men with everything, food, loving, and lodging. And they took me away from her when I was about 3 months of age because she was a brutal drunk, a wicked drunk. And I don't hold that against her. She was my mom. They gave me back to her again, and then they removed me from her when I was about 9 months of age and returned me back to the two people who were my mom and dad, as far as I'm concerned, my whole life that I know of. And what is interesting is I've checked into it, and I wasn't drinking that heavy then. And later on, I got gone. And I see people today that actually can remember back to when they were a year and a half old and 2 years of age. And if I had a memory like that, I'd be dangerous. I don't remember all that stuff. I remember a number of things. But I remember the things that are pertinent to why I'm in this room tonight. When I was about 11 years of age, the young boys in my hometown, the little village I was in, they found out what my real mother done. Today they call them hookers, but they didn't call them that then. And they started teasing me. And I started fighting. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that if you can fight. But it took a good man to beat me. It didn't take him long, but it took a good man. And I get all kinds of people coming into my office today, and they'll say, "Well, I was a good fighter too, Lou." And they got scars going all over them. I said, "Now, I hate to tell you this, and I don't want it to upset you, and it's not personal. Good fighters got no marks." There's a fellow who I mention quite often when I talk, and I have followed his career a bit. And apparently he's quite a scrapper. His name is Sugar Ray Leonard. And his face is just like glass. And he's had a lot of fights. Now, mind, he's won most of them. And I had a hell of a lot of fights. And when you looked at me, mine were all, if you'd look at my face, they were split decisions. And that, the saddest thing about it is we come into AA thinking we were good at the very things we were not good at. And when I was 16 years of age, I got put in jail for 30 days. They had no juvenile jails or homes or any of that. I went to the county jail. I got out of that just before Christmas, and then just prior to my 17th birthday is the thing that I like to mention. This is something that I will take to my grave with me, but I came home on a Wednesday, and I'd been gone 5 days with two of my teenage buddies on a tear up to another part of the country on a drunk. And when I walked in the house, it was just about noon, and my mom was there, and she's a little lady, about 5'2" and about the same width. She did what any mother, I suppose, would do. She started giving me a lecture. And I don't know why, but I hauled off and smashed her right in the face, and she went down in front of our kitchen sink. And I'm the only child. And I grabbed some clothes and took off before Daddy got home, and I went to Halifax, Nova Scotia, two provinces away. 1985, Mom asked me if I'd come back home and see her, and she was 72 years old the next time I seen my mother. And I'm a tough son of a bitch, too. I look around this room tonight, and there's no doubt in my mind there isn't a man in here that can't beat hell out of me, but that don't mean you're tough. We'll find out how tough you are when you go out there and face life on life terms, and everybody you ask a question to says no. Well, we'll find out. This is where toughness is decided. I see people going by me every day in the city I live in, and their fingers are up in the air, and they're shaking their fists, and their mouth is going, and they pull in front of me, and it says, "Live and let live. Easy does it." I'd put them on my dash. With my luck, the person behind me can't read English, and I'm buggered all the way around. But that's where we've always kept vital information, where we can't read it. Always have. And stand back and wonder why people have reacted the way they've reacted. People react the way they're supposed to react. It's like the psychiatrist that went to this mental hospital where he had a whole bunch of alky patients. And about 10 o'clock in the morning, he walked out for a coffee break. And here was this guy with a wheelbarrow full of cement and a bunch of bricks building this wall. He watched him for a while. And he said, "Pray tell me why you're in here." He said, "My family resented me, so they had me committed." Well, he said, "I want to tell you, that brick lane is a piece of symmetrical beauty. I have never seen work like that. We could use people with your talents on the outside of this institution." He said, "I'm on the board of this hospital. When it meets on Thursday, I'm going to stand on your behalf." And he said, "I'll have you out of here on Monday." And he turned to walk away, and this idiot threw a brick and hit him right in the back of the head, and down he went. When he finally come to'd from this clout in the head, he turned to this bird, and he said, "Now, why did you do that?" He said, "I just didn't want you to forget Thursday." And that pretty well tells it the way the drunk's gone through life. And wonder why people reacted the way they reacted. I left the East Coast and left a horrendous trail behind me. I got married to a young lady. It wasn't even a marriage. I look back on my life today, and it's just we got married, and she got pregnant, and I was driving for Allied Van Lines, a truck driver, coast to coast, and I never went back home. And what's amazing is years later, I got married in Vancouver, and my wife had a daughter, and the fact that I never thought I'd ever see my other daughter again, I have two daughters with exactly the same name, Darlene, Lorraine, Finnemore. It's, you know, our life is so tragic in so many ways. And yet I look back today and it is so gifted in many ways. Once we get a philosophy to bring the gifts out, we have a lot of gifts. I arrived in Vancouver 40 years ago. And I've been on most of the leading skid roads of Vancouver and every decent jail. And I've sung in just about every mission for two glazed donuts. And if I accepted Christ as my personal Savior, they'd throw in another one. If I was hungry, I did. And if I wasn't, I didn't. Had nothing to do with faith, believing, acceptance, surrendering. It had all to do with surviving. I did whatever I had to do to survive. And you name it, I've drank it. And I don't get into the drink-by-drink tours that I just don't think it serves too much. I've caused enough grief, enough heartache, and enough sorrow in one lifetime that I believe there's no way I could ever pay back my debt to society. 39 years ago, I was drinking with a guy in the Skid Row, Vancouver. He took me up to this house. It was a friend of his. And it's just, I won't go into the whole story of all the things that happened. But, oh my God, was we drunk. And this was a woman that had just been evicted from a house and moved over two houses, her and four children. And he took me up there, and she threw us both out because we were drunk. Next morning, we woke up. We're sleeping in a car. I said to him, I said, where was that place we was at last night? Oh, he said, that's over in the East End. I said, stop at a store. So we stopped at a store, and I went in and got the ingredients for a breakfast, bacon and eggs, bread. He drove me back to this house where we were at, and we walked in, and I threw the stuff on the table, and I said to the lady there, I said, cook me breakfast. And she did, and I was there for the next 14 years. I'm just like an old dog. You feed me and I don't leave. I just stay. And she became my wife. We have six children. I have 14 grandchildren. And as of 2 weeks ago, I have two great-grandchildren. If you've never lived the life I've lived, you don't know what it is for a child to call you dad. You just don't know. And when a little girl phones your office and you answer the phone, she says, hi, Grandpa, how are you doing? If you've never gone through this, these are the experiences we share. And that's what this thing is all about. This thing walks, talks, and shakes hands. Men make counterfeit money, and money makes counterfeit men. I'm as humble as anybody you met with $50. If I got $5,000, you think Errol Flynn just rolled into the room. This whole thing is about me loving you and you loving me. All my life, I had making love and love all buggered up. And if I'd have forgot about the late making love, I'd have been a lot better respected. And like I said to my wife, I'm a lot like a rabbit. This won't take long, did it? When you listen to the man talking, you'd think, my God, where have I been? But I want to tell you. The performance is no hell, you know. I know what I am, and I know where I've been, and I know what I've done. And it's okay for me today to be just as bad as I was, and it's okay for me today to be just as good as I am. I don't have to pretend to be any better, and I don't have to pretend to be any worse. And so it says we tell in a general way what we were like. Don't make it any worse. Don't make it any glamorous. I don't have to act it out. I don't have to be dramatic. I'm not good at it anyway, but I think the whole thing about it is for me to be as close to me as possible. And every day God allows me to see me a little bit better, with a little more sensitivity, and a little more honesty, and a little more humility. And that lady that I met, when she met me, she got her first introductions to bailiffs. I want to tell you, I don't know if you people know about bailiffs and repossessions, but I want to tell you, she had a bunch of old furniture that came from St. Vincent de Paul, and I thought, that's not good enough for my family. And I was working for a trucking company. Come here. I knew he'd get here. Last time I seen him was in Anchorage, Alaska, reading a portion of Chapter 5 from Field and Stream at the zoo. But I started buying new furniture, and it just come and it went, and it come and it went. And Winnie and I would split up, and I'd wander back and split up and wander back. And you have no idea what I was like as a dad and a husband. You know, one night we had company in our house. And one thing that has always amazed me is how the alcoholic can adjust to a situation. We were sitting in their front room, and in them old homes in the East End, they all had these softwood floors, and everyone was talking and holding conversation, and I had to go to the bathroom. And I happened to be one of these people, and when I did, I never moved. I just stayed stationary. And I went, and it ran right through this chair I was in, right across the floor under the coffee table. And do you think I stopped talking? Not a bit. I had some important things I was discussing. That never bothered me at all. Another night I got up and I had, I was amazing how often I had to go to the bathroom. I got up out of bed and I don't know what I was doing. I turned around, my wife was laying there and she got it right in the face. She came out of that bed like a wild person, you know, very narrow-minded. No sense of humor whatsoever. And you laugh about that. When she came out of that bed, you know what I said? What the hell's the matter with you? How indignant to get up in the middle of the night screaming at me when I'm trying the best I can. And I'm going to tell you, my whole life was pretty much like that. My oldest son has talked about it. I messed my pants downtown, and I stayed like that for 3 days. When I came in here and said, what an odor, I can't go through with that. It wasn't what an order. I mean, and this was my whole life. So on November the 16th of 1963, I got thrown out of the Rainier beer parlor from what I pray to God was my last drunk. And that's the worst beer parlor in the Skid Row of Vancouver at Carolyn Cordova. And how I got back up to where Winnie and the kids was living, I have no idea. But somehow, I knocked on the door, and she opened the door, and she let me come in. And there was a wife and five children. Had another one after sobered up. But I want to tell you the situation. The lights were shut off. The phone was disconnected. She was on welfare. All the furniture was repossessed. In them days, the only thing they couldn't repossess in British Columbia was the beds the kids were sleeping on. They couldn't take those. They could take everything else. She was cooking on a Coleman camp stove what she had to feed the five children. And Einstein knocked on the door. I lay down on the floor and I went to bed. And the next morning, I get up until this day, I have no idea where I ever heard about it. No idea. But I look at her and I said, what's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous? And her very words to me were, if you want the goddamn number, go look it up. That's the most she'd said in ages. And I thought, now she wants me to come back home. Wasn't no good looking up. We had no phone. But I looked up the number and I went next door and I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous. And the most beautiful lady answered the phone, Lucy. And she never asked me a whole lot of questions like they do now. You fill out a whole sheet now when you phone in, the people that takes the call. She just asked me, where do you live? How old are you? I told her. She said, I'll have two men come to see you. Now, I had a whole bunch of intellectual questions for these two whenever they arrived. And I sat there waiting. And all of a sudden, these two men came. And you know, you talk about a born loser. They sent two of the dumbest bastards I've ever met in my entire life. And they are back from where I'm born, the East Coast. Now, when two people come in and you all got a set on the floor, you shouldn't have a lot to say. But I was really wound up. And they sat beside each other, these two brothers. And one would talk a little bit, and his other brother was sitting there, and he'd bang him in the ribs. And he'd say, ain't that right, Don? He'd say, yep. And that's all he said. Every time he got hit in the ribs, he'd say, yep. Now, I mean, even I'm smart enough, I'd have moved over. But that was my first sign that these weren't the sharpest knives in the drawer. But when I get wound up, the other guy, brother, he'd say, oh, easy does it, Lou. And then I'd be gone way down the roadways, and he'd say, no, we do this one day at a time. And then I'd get at my neighbor, and he'd say, oh, live and let live. And I said, boy, you've been watching the seagulls too long to let these two in. One can say one word, and the other can say four. And yet they were carrying this message. And they were both sober. And do you know I never picked up on that? I never picked up on that. 5 o'clock around that, they decided to leave. And the smart one, the four-word guy, he said, now just remember, if you don't take that first drink, you'll stay sober. And I thought, he's got something. He said, we'll be back at 8 o'clock to get you and take you to a meeting. Well, 3 months later, it hit me. How inconsiderate you can be to get two guys to drive 40 miles to tell you if you don't drink, you'll stay sober. I'd never thought of that. And we think that they're smart. No, if you just talk common sense to a drunk, he won't know what in the hell's going on. You got him right where the hair is short. Stay out of that theory stuff. They love that. They went out the door, and this is the thing that I really want to really go to town. I went out of our house and across the street to a house that a man lived at, and I had been drinking with him the day before. A lot of people have laughed about this story, but there really is not a lot. It's not funny. I ran up his back stairs and across his patio and in his kitchen. He's sitting there with a glass of whiskey, and he went to take a drink. I said, "Put that down, kill you." Now, you can't. No, I won't tell you. You can't explain an expression. You got to see it. I can't even look like he did. He said, "What happened to you?" I said, "I quit drinking." And he took another look at me, and he said, "When?" I said, "There must be 6-8 hours now." He said, "Will you leave?" And I did. He's never spoke to me from that day to this. Now, what does her book say? If you open it up right in the very beginning, it says, unquote, "And the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, not AA, can win the confidence of his fellow alcoholics in a matter of hours. Until this has been done, little or nothing can be accomplished." And here the Oral Roberts of AA living in Little Italy is headed out to get them to pour their wine. Now, I know none of you people are like me. You didn't come to AA and your next day phoning up all your drunken relatives trying to get them to go to a meeting and sober them up. It says, "After we found the solution." So they picked me up and took me to my first meeting. 6 foot tall, 29 years old, 133 pounds, 4 pounds of that's ears. I had them wine sores all over me, for if there's any winos here that was born to the purple like us. I had a black shoe on and a brown one. You still can't get shoes like that in the same box, that is. I walked into this meeting, and Jerry was there at the door, and he said, "Welcome, you're in the right place." And I thought, now he spotted something nobody else has ever recognized. Only a judge had ever told me where I was in the right place. Nobody had ever told me I was in the right place before. And they took me up and set me right in the front row, second chair over in front of the speakers. And every one of them was sort of all vintage models, my age, the speakers. Most of them had no teeth. And you know them old birds years ago, them suspenders, they could lean way back and their head touch the floor and their feet never come off. And back up they'd come again. And they'd look at you and they'd say, "Material thing don't mean nothing." And I thought, well, if I looked like that, material things wouldn't mean a hell of a lot to me neither. And I'd watch them all leave in Buicks and Lincolns and Cadillacs, and I thought, now I missed something in their bloody talk. And you know, it's interesting. Material things mean bugger all to me today, because I got them. Now, this book clarifies a whole lot of things in here. A lot of interesting things in this book. And I think it's nice that we know. It says in here that there is a solution. There is one. Contrary to what popular belief that there isn't, it says there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful confirmation. It tells me here that getting sober and staying sober is a process. It just don't happen like that. It just don't happen like that. And I hear people say all kinds of things here that I can't find in this book. Make no major decisions for the first year. Really? But we'd like you to admit you're an alcoholic, your life is unmanageable. Come to believe in something you can't feel, touch, or hear, and turn your life over, which is vitally important to that person. Take a list of every bloody thing that's wrong with you and tell it to a complete stranger. Make a list of all the people you've harmed and become willing to meet them face to face, but don't make any major decision for the first year. Honestly. These are bloody major decisions. No relationships for the first year. The people that told me that, it's easy to say that when you're leaving with your partner. I never had a single person tell me that. It talks about relationships when AA boy meets AA girl on AA campus. We don't get drunk because of relationship or relationships. We get drunk for the line of BS we gave her to get into the relationship. And this is what this whole thing is all about, is telling us precisely what's going on. And it tells me that I cannot do it myself. In the spiritual appendix in the back, it says, what has happened is he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. Not to life. In his reaction to life. That which he could not have done on his unaided strength alone. So they're telling me my problem was my reaction to what I seen, heard, or happened. Not what happened. And so this is the thing that I have to look at when it says the main problem with the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. You can talk about any portion of a man's anatomy. He didn't even brag about some of them, but don't discuss his head. He don't like in there anyone in there unsolicited telling him he's crazy. So this is, you don't realize once you're sober a while how comforting this becomes to know that your problems are not from the waist down, they're from the neck up. Like, actually, 10 square inches, I never leave home without it. Take it right with me. So my problems are not all over the world. I was just a while ago speaking in Gulfport, Mississippi. A lady said, where do you live? I said, right here. Oh, she said, I thought you're Canadian. I said, I have an address there too. And now she's really getting confused. She didn't even know where she lived then. I said, this is where I'm enjoying life right now, today. I'm living right here. You see, where my mailing address is where I live when I'm there. But I've been given a daily reprieve, which is contingent upon my spiritual growth. And so I'm growing all over the country. All over the country. Today, I'm living in Oakland. The only sad thing about this is my wife's not here. This is the first time that Linda's not been with me. She's two-thirds of my marriage. She's like an American Express card. I don't leave home without her. Doug is here, and he can verify. My wife and I have never had an argument or disagreement. Never. And that's not because of me. My nature is to argue. We've never had it for the simple reason this program has taught me. When I become your friend and you show that you want to be my friend, my job is just to love you, not change you. And you see, our big problem, as I see today, as soon as we meet somebody, have you ever thought of doing this? Have you ever thought of going there? And they said, have you ever thought of bugger not? I don't know why we have such an obsession to change people. And when you look up the meaning of the word obsession, whatever it is you're obsessed with, it says you are obsessed with an idea, not a fact. You are obsessed with an idea, excluding all other ideas. In this book, it says you are about to take the first accurate self-appraisal. Now, only for a drunk would they say accurate. For anyone else, they'd just say take a self-appraisal. For us, it said accurate. This program is something else when you really get into it. I started a Navelco step meeting strictly out of the big book in the 12 and 12 30 years ago, and I've never missed a Monday meeting. It takes 18 weeks. Steps 11 and 12 are in three distinct parts. They're not just all one step. Look at the commas in there. So there ain't no sense being in a hurry. Get through them if you're planning on being here for a long time. But I hear people say, I went through the steps. I can't find that. It says, here are the steps we took. It says only step one can be taken with 100% perfection. The remaining 11 are steps are perfect ideals. They are yardsticks by which we judge our progress. If I'm not in them every week, how do I know whether I'm at 28 inches or 32 and a half? You know, I went through a lot of things. But I think this is when they talk about accurate. You see, I look at the Ten Commandments. You know, it says, thou shalt not commit adultery. AA says, did you ever? Quite a bit different, ain't it? Ooh. Like they strip the bitches right off you. Like they go way back. It's not from here on. And thou shalt not steal. Our book said, did you ever? Oh, big difference. They want an accurate appraisal. They want said, trust God, clean house, and help others. They didn't say, paint the outside, put some shutters on, mow the lawn, plant some roses. They said, clean house. See, I always done exterior work like that. It says when we have to choose between personal comfort and character building, it says character building gets lost in the dust, it says in our book. So after that first meeting, in the situation we was in, that was November the 16th of 1963. And 4 weeks later, I found one sucker to lend me $200, and I bought a truck and started a trucking company. $200 truck. A couple of 3 weeks later, I got a good one, $700 truck. Burnt 5 gallons of re-refined oil a day. The next thing I got through a finance company was a Cadillac. I'm not going into how I got it. The important thing for a drunk is you get a Cadillac. Look impressive. It's far better to look successful than to be successful. And it's quicker to get there. This was an absolute nightmare. I got some business cards printed that cost more than the truck did. You should have seen these. I still have some today. These were absolutely magnificent. All black embossed cards with gold embossed lettering. Citywide Cartage Moving and Storage. Louis Finnemore, president. If you're the only bloody employee, call yourself whatever in the hell you want. I was chairman of the board 1 week and chief executive officer the next, and I got so busy looking for the second truck, they repossessed the first one. And one night, we were having dinner, and we heard this little clunk, clunk, and looked out in the back, and away went the Cadillac. It was gone. Now, it's interesting how this all works, and it's all in this book. When you buy a car or anything else, and you finance it, and they explain that all to you. Now, Mr. Finnemore, you give us $241.88 a month. You keep this car. If you don't, you take it back. And it was just my luck. I always dealt with people that kept their end of the bargain. They took it back. And you know the proper thing for the drunk to do is run around AA saying, don't ever deal with that Avco Delta. What a bunch of bandits they are. No, they're fine business people. High interest rates. You know, there's a lot of things. Like every company that's ever fired me is still doing well. And I used to think you'll regret it. And that maybe they... But on the back of these car deals and rent deals, that when you turn it over, which we never do, because you sign the front, you don't sign the back, it says conditional sales agreement, doesn't it? Now, what's it say in our book? It says, we thought conditions drove us to drink, and when we couldn't change the conditions to our entire satisfaction, our drinking went out of control. It never occurred to us that we had to change ourselves to meet the conditions. There is the whole problem. We had to change to meet the conditions. And that's what I'm so grateful for today, is that I've met the conditions of every contract that I've signed. And you see, I really become aware of the old timers that was honest with me. You know, I ran around talking about all the money owed. I was in small debts court 41 times my first 2 years sober. I owed $7,300 at 51 different places. That ain't much 35 years ago, but it'd be like $400,000 today. And I ran around talking about all this money I owed, and I remember old Gordy, the first man that rode into AA in British Columbia. He got up at a meeting one night, about 150 people there. He said, you know, Lou, you've been talking about all this money owed. You ever considered repaying it? And I thought, now that's a different approach. You know? I thought I was really doing good admitting I owed it. And then I realized that as a result of that, I realized where this new word in our vocabulary today, stress, came from. If you don't intend paying it, don't admit you owe it. That's stressful. God, that's a bugger. But do you know, 6 weeks before Christmas, and I quit drinking, and that Christmas, somebody brought us a Christmas tree and the decorations and had our lights hooked up. And somebody brought Winnie and I and the children a Christmas dinner and everything to go with it. And somebody else, I don't know who, seen that every one of my kiddies had one Christmas present under our tree. And that set up a little pattern for me. From that day on, I've made my own Christmas hampers up and delivered them myself. If you've never had that happen, you don't know the value of a Christmas present under the tree from one of your kiddies. And so you see, AA has supplied me with every single thing I needed. It has supplied me with every single thing I needed. And the thing that I was constantly made aware of by old Joe was, are you grateful? Are you really grateful for where you are, what you got, who you are, where you've been, where you're going? It's like the lady that lived in upstate New York. And her son lived down in Florida, and he had 2 children, a boy and a girl, which was her grandchildren. He wouldn't let her come see him. Because she was a drunk. And finally she sobered up. He said, okay, Mom, you can come down and see the kids. So she come down. And the first day she was there, she took the little boy and little girl down by the ocean, set them right by the water. And all of a sudden, a wave came in and picked the little boy up and washed him right out in the ocean. And she looked up and said, "Dear God, if you've never done anything for me before in your life, would you please return my grandson?" And you know, in the next split second, another wave came in and plunked him right at her feet. And she looked down and looked back up and said, "He had a cap." And this is how I have to measure my gratitude. This is how I have to measure my gratitude. It's just that way. It's just that way. I started involved with prisons, and I started the first meeting at Agassiz Correctional Prison, and the first one in Mountain Prison in 1966, and the first big book study at Alouette River Jail in 1967. And my wife and I, Winnie and I, had 523 people live in our home in 9.5 years out of prisons and penitentiaries. And I look back, I can think of 18 men that all served over 24 years that never had a drink from the day they got out until they died or until right now. This thing does work. This, if we're going in there with the right motives, and we're going in there for the purpose we're meant to go in for. And I think these are the things that I started to learn as a result of these steps. This step meeting that we started, we just started another series a week ago. I have a massive amount of paperwork, a step one that's all done out, and there's two different parts of a step two that's all, and it's all in there, what page in the big book, and the 12 and 12 you find it, because I find a lot of people in step meetings, if they don't know exactly where to find something, they won't look for it, because it says we've done the searching, fearless, more limited. And it said one, it said that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say that we're alcoholics. Look up the meaning of the word powerless. It says the powerlessness over alcohol was the fact that I'd go out and taken a drink knowing what the last drunk did to me and the one before, and I couldn't stop taking that drink that day. And it doesn't say that my life was becoming unmanageable. It tells me that it's arrived, Fenimore. It's here. Like it's Nowsville, man. It said our life had become unmanageable, and it doesn't say anything about your ability to make a living. It said the way I lived and the way I looked at life was unmanageable. And then they said we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. It doesn't say in a power greater than ourselves. And I find sometimes that I hear people say, now as I interpret step three, if you look up the meaning of the word interpretation in some of the dictionaries, it says avoidance of truth. This book does not need me to interpret it. It doesn't need anybody else to interpret it for you. It's laid out very simply. There's no big words. And it said, we came to believe that a power greater than yourself. They're telling me that is the only way. That is the only way. See, because believing is not our problem. We use that as something just to get hung up on. Trusting is our problem, not believing. I live in the city of Vancouver. When I go downtown, I look up, and there's three beautiful ski runs in the mountains. And I believe the cable going up Gross Mountain is very strong, but I don't trust it enough to get in that gondola. Trust is our problem, not believing. So that's when I look at these steps, where they are and how they're worded, precisely, exactly how they're worded, I have no troubles. It's only when this keen alcoholic mind of mine starts interpreting them so that I can look smarter than the new guy, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. Said, so we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I've been involved in vintage cars for a lot of years. So being not really smart, I had to look up the meaning of the word restore. And it says to return to original form. So it tells me that when I was a little boy, I trusted and I believed and I forgave. I had all those qualities. So it ain't telling me that I'm a miracle. It tells me that I'm being returned to something that I once was. Which, this program is so simple that it's unbelievable. And it said we made a decision to turn our will and our lives, my thinking and my actions, our will and our life. It's nothing else. But it doesn't say I turn it over to God. Because you see, any time I turn something over to anybody, I'm turning it over to them for them to do it. It says I turn it over to the care of God. And so if I ask somebody if they'll babysit our little boy while we go to the opera, all that's saying is they're taking care of my little boy, and when the opera's over, we pick him up and carry on raising him. And so these steps outline a real explicit program of how I'm supposed to live today. And out of all the steps, it's the only one where they ask us to make a decision because they know it's not one of our strong points. Agreeing with Him, yes. Not making them. Not making them. And so I think these are the things that we get back, that we look at. Is what does it say? And it says that we made a searching and fearless moral, not a fearful immoral. A searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I've got five step fours all made out. Five different ones. And when you realize that every human being has 26 assets and everyone has 26 defects, so the good are half bad and the bad are half good. So I don't think it's wise to be any worse than you were or any better than you are. An accurate self-appraisal. Then it says that we made a decision to, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And then we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being. The exact nature, there's no S on that word, it's singular. I was always into the natures. The reason I don't get into my story, because then I start exaggerating. Start lying. The first 3 years I was in AA, I told some of the most atrocious, bloody stories, just so I'd qualify about being over in Korea in the Army. I couldn't even get a Sally Ann uniform. And I've listened to people tell stories, and in some cases they're not that old. They ain't old enough. I'm just what I am. It says the exact nature of our wrongs. And so, when I done a retreat last fall in Oregon, there were three priests there doing step fives. They allowed each person a half an hour. They didn't need you to tell everything you'd done wrong. I'd say, well, I was unfaithful on my wife. They said, we know that. We want to know why. I was a liar. Yeah, we know that. Why? I was felt inferior. Okay, you don't have to tell me how many times. Why? You see, we try to avoid the nature of the wrongs. We want to tell everybody what we've done wrong. And consequently, it just becomes fruit. And then you get into 6 and 7 where it says, we become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. One is the thought process, one is the action process. But the whole thing about it, I hear people say, even where I'm around, they'll say, you know, I'm working so hard on anger. It says we're entirely ready to have God remove that. And we humbly ask Him. But the fact we don't rely on Him too well, you see, I turned a lot of things over to God and He turned them right over to a bailiff and they repossessed Him. He's very unreliable in a lot of areas. There's many things you just can't trust Him with. So the whole thing about it is that we will not follow the instructions for some unknown reason. I don't know why. It's like the old guy that went to the doctor and he said to the doctor, he said, you know, the wife and I married 40 years and he said our sex life is just shot. He said, I don't know what's the matter. She could care less. He said, look, I'm going to give you this prescription. He said, when you go home tonight and you're having your tea or coffee before you go to bed, he said, just drop a couple of these in hers. So they're sitting there and he said, sweetheart, he said, look at that gorgeous moon. And she looked out and he dropped two in hers and he thought, to hell, I'll put two in mine too. So he did. And they both went to bed and fell sound asleep. About 3 o'clock in the morning, she woke up out of this deep sleep and sat up and threw her hands up and said, I need a man. 2 minutes later, he woke up and sat up and threw his hands up and said, me too! So, you don't have to wish nothing on a drunk. Leave him alone. He will screw it up himself. Stay out of his personal affairs. This is the bottom line. If you mind your own business, someday you have a business of your own to mind. You see, but as long as I can be minding yours, then I can go home and feel sorry for what I don't have. And this book outlines it all so clearly. And we just don't see that. We just don't see that. We just don't see it. We see what happens. We watch the television, but for some unknown reason, we don't get the message. It's like the Pope when he was in Vancouver at BC Place Stadium, 60,000 people. And after the service was over, he asked if there was anybody who would like to be prayed for to come forward. And a bunch of people come down. And this lady come up, and she was blind, and he prayed for her and blessed her, and she could see. And another man was standing there in crutches, and he prayed for him, and he blessed him, and he threw the crutches away and walked away. And that night, the Pope was going back to his hotel room at the Hotel Vancouver, and he walked across the lobby and pressed the button, and the elevator doors flew open, and there was a guy in there in crutches, and he said, don't touch me, I'm on workers' compensation. So, not too often does the drunk see anything that he sees, and he don't hear it, whatever in hell he hears. He sees what he thinks he sees, and he heard what he thought he heard. And so for me, I really have to let you know what I'm like. I have to let you know what I was like. The insecurities, the low self-esteem, the inferiority complex that I had. Like, I want to tell you, I was made fun of my whole life as a little boy. And that's why at these podiums, I do not think I ever have the God-given right to ever make a comment about any AA member that's not going to make you think more of them. I don't ever want to belong to a group or go to a meeting where it's a laugh-in or Rowan and Martin, you know, where all the catcalls are going on. You don't. It says in the book, we are very sensitive people. And it's fine for me, but is that gal or that guy, are they as thick-skinned as I am? It says, I must be hard on myself but considerate of others. Am I that? That little just for today page we have, two little pages that a lot of us use. Just for today, I'll dress becomingly, talk low, ask courteously, criticize not one bit, not try to change or improve or anyone other than myself. It's true what Abraham Lincoln says, that most folks are as happy as they make up their mind to be. One guy cut one of them all up, all them little pieces up, put them in a jar. And then he cut the border all the way around all up and put it in. Someone said, what's the border for? He said, that's a day off. So, you don't realize how many times we're looking for a day off. We are given a daily reprieve which is contingent upon our spiritual growth. There is no days off. Like, I have no problems at all. I average 5 meetings a week, every week of the year. Nevertheless, I'm the program director for the Winners Foundation of the BC Racing Commission, horse racing, thoroughbred, and standardbred horse racing. We just had the third leg of the Triple Crown in Belmont today in New York. And I visit all them racetracks. And on our racetrack, 4 years ago, Kentucky picked our program as the role model program for all the racetracks in North America. We have about 228 people sober on our 2 racetracks today, 4 meetings a week, and it is all AA. We don't get into cognitive behavioral problems, or, well, I can't say it anyway. So maybe that's why we're not in it. We keep it very simple. We have 4 meetings a week, and it just works fine. And that's what this book tells me. Don't louse it up. Keep it simple. And it said we made a list of all persons we have harmed. It doesn't say hurt. And so I can't afford to change one word. You see, I can leave here today and tear this lady to shreds all over the state of California. And 4 years from now, she hears about it. And she says, how could a friend hurt me like that? But for 4 years, it was harm. You see, the tongue located in a damp area has a tendency to slip when moving fast. And Dr. Bob said to Bill, he said, Bill, we must watch our errant tongues. And it's comforting to know from that day to this, there's never been a word of gossip in Alcoholics Anonymous. But see, that's what this thing says. It says, we made a list of all persons we have harmed, become willing to make amends to them all. They're asking for willingness. Then it said, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible. It doesn't say whenever possible. I hear more people today saying, you know I owe Ann an apology, and when I see her, I'm going to make it. Uh-uh. That is not what it said. It says, go find Ann and make it. Because if my eyesight serves me correctly, I'm not going to see Ann. And you see, I hear lots of people apologize, and I hate to tell them, an apology is not an amend. An apology is merely an acknowledgement that I thought it, said it, or done it. When they amend the criminal code of the United States, they don't all stand up and apologize. Maybe they should. They change it, and an amend is to change. I can come along and apologize saying, you know, I'm sorry I gossiped about you last week. That's just an apology. The amend is don't ever gossip about that person again. That's the thing that we have trouble with. We have no trouble with apologies. So this is the thing that these steps have done for me. They've got me to live a life today that I'm so proud of. And you people gave it to me. And you never charged me nothing for it. And you never stood in judgment of me. And you were patient with me. And you love me. And you fed my children. And you got them to love you before they love me. And that's neat that they had someone to love. See, and I've grown up enough today that I allow my children to love someone else, even when they're angry at me. They need that. We all need someone to love.
And that's what these steps have allowed me to really get an insight of me. You don't know me. You're just listening to me. But I've come a long, long way. Like my wife said to me one day, she said, "Do you never get mad?" And I got 41 convictions in 5 years against me in that police station. And I used to say it was for fighting. Until an old-timer said, "Have you ever read what those charges are?" It says, he said, "Lou, that they read, you've been charged with creating a disturbance in a public place." He said, "You couldn't even fight good enough to get an assault charge." And that's what I did when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just run around disturbing people. And that is not my purpose. That is not my purpose, to disturb people. Not at all. My job is to be of maximum service, it says, to God and my fellow man. I sold that trucking business after 12 years, and the man who I brought to AA, who owned four of the largest custom design jewelry stores in the city of Vancouver, phoned me one day to have lunch, and when I went up, he said, "I don't know what the hell you're doing moving furniture." He said, "I've listened to you talk at meetings and your step meetings," and he said, "How would you like to manage my main jewelry store?" I said, "I'd love it." And why in the hell I said that, I don't know. But I put an ad in the paper, I sold a trucking company, and all of a sudden I'm sitting at Ragnar Jewelers, 12th and Granville. And my first morning there, he went to the bank, and a lady came in who owned the most expensive lady store in the city and dumped out some gemstones on a beautiful burgundy felt pad and said, "What can you do with these?" And I felt like St. Puke, you know. I didn't know a ruby was red or an emerald was green, and I thought, now I'm in another bloody jackpot. He came back afterwards and straightened this mess out. That night when I was going home, he said, "You forget about an AA meeting tonight, Lou." He said, "I want you to write down every possible reason somebody wouldn't want to buy a piece of jewelry in the store." What he was talking about was handling objections. That's what this thing's all about. It's for me to learn how to handle objections. At the end of that month, his sales were $7,800 and mine was just over $33,000. I've never looked back. I've been selling ever since something. I worked there 3 years and I quit and went selling Electrolux vacuum cleaners to get some experience in rejection. You sure as hell get it there, I'll tell you that. There's one story about that. They still tell it at Electrolux conventions. It was my third day in the job. I had never done direct selling in my entire life. I rang this lady's doorbell, and boy, I was really fired up from all these motivational meetings. And she came to the door, and I handed her my card. I said, "Good morning, I'm Mr. Fenimore. I'm your Electrolux representative in this area now." And she slammed that bloody door. I never knew houses could even stay erect with doors slammed like that. And why the hell I done it, I don't know. I went around the back of the house and rang her doorbell. When she come there, I said, "Geez, I hope you're not as unhappy as the lady was just at the front door." Yeah. That's another expression you can't describe. She said, "Would you like a coffee?" I said, "I'd love one." I never sold her a vacuum cleaner. I didn't have to. I sold lots of them. And I never sold one to an AA member or any members of my family. I knocked door to door. We broke down a barrier, her and I. And I found out what was bothering her, and that was so important that she had someone she could talk to. We remained friends, her and I. She lived a block from where I did. But do you know, when you think that Alcoholics Anonymous has broken down barriers in communist countries that all the political powers in the world couldn't do, and we were invited there. I think it's so important to know what you belong to. To read AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and to get to know what we belong to. I always like what old Joe said. He said, if you don't read them books, he said, maybe you're still a visitor. And so I think it's so important to know what it belonged to. 50 years, this convention, these people know what they belong to. You know, we belong to the largest. Chuck C. said to me one time, he said, when you go out of your door every morning, Lou, travel first class, you're representing the largest company in the world. He didn't mean that I always had to stay in the Hyatt, travel first class. Another thing, one time I was speaking, Chuck and I were together, and he said, you know, Lou, you and a lady can go to Seattle for the weekend, enjoy each other, and have a great time. And he said, if you go back to Vancouver and get drunk, he said, alcohol is a major problem. You're nuts. People don't get drunk over what they enjoyed. He said, what you get drunk over was what I said earlier, the line of BS you gave her to get her to Seattle. All you got to do is be honest, and you'll get whatever you should have on that given day. You may not get what you want, but you will get what you should get on that given day. And then, isn't it amazing when Dr. Bob and Bill pleaded with the drunk to be honest? And you get down to step 10, and they knew precisely how honest we were. We'd done an inventory in 4, and we'd done an inventory in 8, and now they're saying continue to take inventory. And when you're wrong, it doesn't say if you're wrong. It says promptly admitted it. It doesn't say to explain it. And I found that I never admitted anything in my life. I'd say to this lady, I'm sorry for what I said to you last Saturday night. And if she didn't say something back, I said, but now the reason I said it is this. And give me 3 minutes and I'll have her apologize and she was even at the party and that's what I want. This says when you're wrong, admit it and slip. Don't discuss it no more. And this is the thing that the steps have given me. This is the thing that the steps has given me. Is the opportunity to look at why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. How many of us really know? Like alcohol was merely the transportation system that got me here. Alcohol wasn't my problem. If they was, then I shouldn't have never done any of the things I'd done after I came to AA. It's like the guy that died and went to heaven. And God ushered him into this magnificent room. And he said to him, he said, look, when you get unpacked, I'll come and show you around. About a half an hour later, God came back and walked in. The guy said to God, he said, what's this I see down here in the clouds? He says, a whole bunch of young people down there drinking rock music, going dancing, having a ball. God said, oh, that's hell. Well, he said, you sent me to the wrong place. That's where I'm supposed to be. So they gathered up his gear and they shipped him down and he arrived in this filthy, dirty, stinking, grungy hole of a room. And Satan came in. The guy said, what's this? Satan said, this is hell. And he said, what's this I see up here in the clouds? A whole bunch of young people, rock music, going, drinking, dancing, having a ball. He said, that's our marketing department. See, that's what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous was a number of marketing departments. Alcohol was just the transportation system. And it's too bad. I'm sorry I blame liquor for so many things. That is so unjustly blamed for so many things. You know, I even see like in AA, some guy can go urinate in the parking lot and there's two guys watching. One guy said, what do you expect? He's an alcoholic. And the other guy said, at least he's sober. No, no. See, there is no excuse for a lot of the actions that I had when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to live a life today where I don't have to excuse myself anymore. I don't have to excuse myself anymore. And he said, we sought through prayer and meditation. It tells me that's the only media there is. There is no other one. Prayer and meditation. To improve our conscious, which is awake or aware with God. Now, here's an assumption of AA that I've got a contact. They're assuming that at this stage of the game. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us. What does it say in the book, God's will for us? To be happy, joyous, and free. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. How can I be happy? How can I be joyous? And how can I be free if I'm not trying to bring happiness, joy, and freedom in your life? You know, if I wake up with the gimmies and go to bed with the wants, it don't work. And I is the smallest word in the English language and carries the least amount of importance, yet we start every word statement out with I. I remember years ago, Dr. Jack from New York was in B.C., and he noticed something, is that the Lord's Prayer is never used in meetings there. They are in the group that I belong to, but they're just not used. And he was a quiet little man, and we were sitting talking one day. He said, well, maybe the reason it's not used is there's no I in it. And I laughed about that, and I got thinking, isn't that sad? We don't use too much that doesn't have an I in it. We just don't. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And then it says, having had a spiritual awakening, and I looked that one up in the dictionary, and it says a complete transformation of thought. So if I have completely changed my way of thinking, not my way of dressing, not my way of living, my way of thinking, because I can disguise my thinking. I can live a particular way today to satisfy you, but I don't think that way. And these are the things that I have to do. If I have completely changed my way of thinking as a result of these steps, it says then we try to carry this message and practice these principles in all our affairs. And there's 36 principles comes out of the 12 steps when you search them out. We have them all listed in our step meeting. I have a 13-page deal on sex and sobriety, and everything that's in there tells you what page you'll find it in the big book and the 12 and 12. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with sex. If you haven't tried it, don't knock it. But the thing about it, the sad thing about it is we think all we got to do is have that person for a sponsor and that'll end that. Well, it didn't for me. Fenimore's problem was Fenimore. I've had some great privileges in this fellowship. In 1985, I think one of the greatest experiences I ever had was I got a phone call and asked if I would speak at their convention. And I said, where? And they said, in the Republic of South Africa. And I've always had a job since I sobered up where I could take as much time as I wanted to. So I went for 3 months, and I spoke at their convention in Pretoria, and then they flew me to 26 different places throughout Africa. And I stopped in Nairobi, was at the end of it, and then my last day was I went up into Ethiopia. And I think sometimes, am I really grateful, I was able to just watch unbelievable amounts of little tummies stop moving, and picked up with a piece of canvas and thrown into a ditch and buried. And we're bellyaching because we had Kraft dinner 3 times in 1 week. And they won't ever know what it tastes like. I went into Zululand out of Durban up into the Valley of 1,000 Hills. And the year before I was there, Buthelezi, who's head of the Zulu tribe, would not allow the President of the United States in there. And here a tramp from Vancouver got in there because his wife had 18 months of sobriety. AA is a fabulous organization. It'll build a bridge over anywhere you want to walk. It'll make you the freest person that you could ever dream of being. And I think this is the thing that we look at, is that I don't know why we do it. I've been as guilty as the other one. We get that new guy or new gal, and you've got to go to 5 meetings a day and get on the club and do this, and all of a sudden they're starting to go to sleep, and you're thinking, I'm getting them. No, they're sleeping. And we think, God, I've just got a spell over them. I remember old Joe in Texas one time, he said he heard a lady speaking. She said, I was at a meeting last night and it was so spiritual you could feel it. He said, down here we call them bareback riders, they don't need a saddle. I mean, spirituality in the dictionary says the opposite of materialism. Anything, as long as I don't have a material value to it, is spiritual. To look at the people I'm looking at, the smiles, is very spiritual. It's very spiritual. I'll take that with me. That goes wherever I go. But I think of the minister that went to this little cowboy town on Sunday morning, was sitting up behind the pulpit, and he looked down, there was one cowboy there. And he went down and said, well, there's only two of us. Do you think we should hold service? Well, he said, Reverend, he said, I don't know a great deal about preaching, but I know quite a bit about cattle. And if I pulled up to a crowd, a load of hay, and there was a cow there, I'd feed it. So he got the message. And he went up and gave this poor bird everything he had in scripture, verse, and song. And when he got down, he came down, he said, what'd you think? He said, well, Reverend, I don't know a lot about preaching, but I know quite a bit about cattle. If I pulled up to a crowd, a load of hay, there was a cow there, he said, I wouldn't give it the whole load. One of our jockeys, I had him out playing golf with him one day, and he said to me, you know, Louis said, riding a horse in a race, he said, it's a lot like AA. I said, what do you mean? He said, you just go to the front and improve your position. Do that. Go to the front and improve your position. Don't go to the back of the pack. You're out of the money. Not only that, you're out of the race. So it's easy. You can decide right here tonight. You can establish a date right now that you will never relinquish. I don't care what happens. There is not one person in this room that ever needs to get drunk to prove to me that this thing don't work. It does. Where I come from, it seems that relapse is a part of getting sober. I don't know why, but it is. No, we don't. You don't have to do it. I have a wonderful life today. I have a wonderful family today. I have some friends today that are so genuine that you just wouldn't even believe these people would be your friends. We just got back from a lovely holiday in Portugal. And we do a lot of traveling. Just prior to that, we were in New Zealand and Singapore and Korea. I'm pretty lucky when I think that 34 years ago, this last Christmas, I was singing in the Skid Road Mission. You people have been so good to me. You've given me so much. And probably if there's anything that bothers me is I've given so little in return. If you're coming here just to get something, I pray you get it. I really do, whatever it is. But I'll guarantee you one thing, and this is sharing experiences, this is not my opinion. If you don't try to help the other alcoholic up that ladder, you'll lose whatever you come here to get. That's what this thing is all about. Give and ye shall receive. You know, in the back of the book in Freedom from Bondage, she said that I received an average amount of intellectual training and education, but there had been no emotional maturity at all. She said, I realize now that this phase of my development had been arrested with my obsession with self. I've done. And I can get into that just like that without even thinking about it. I've done so many things and gone so many places and had so many great experiences. And, you know, I'm not really excited about all the changes I've made at all. But I'm really quite excited about the ones I still have to make. I'm finding as you get older, you'll make rapid changes. This is not a program that you just take for granted. I started playing golf when I'm 40, and I'm left-handed, and I rent the whole golf course. I meet people that no one else even knows is playing golf. I have a hell of a lot of fun, and I don't get all uptight about it, never get mad. You know, we let a threesome or foursome play through one time, and a smart guy walking by me said, you don't hit a golf ball very far, do you? And I said, no, never lose any, neither. I keep my eye right on it. And he just carried on, and I remember one night, if you can't laugh, I remember one night Sammy Davis was on Johnny Carson's show, and he had played that day in a pro-am with President Ford. And Johnny said to Sammy, he said, you played with President Ford today. He said, what's your handicap? And Sammy said, you ask a one-eyed black Jew what his handicap is? I mean, if we can't learn to laugh, we're in trouble. This is the whole thing about it, is learn to laugh. That's the joy that's inside of you that you're keeping bottled up with all your problems, pushing it down. And that's why they put a release valve on a pressure cooker. We have the same thing, only comes out the front instead of the top. So, I'm so grateful for everything you people have given me. I'm so grateful for all the privileges that AA has felt that I was able to do, that they allowed me to do. To serve on the committees that I've served on, to be involved in the prisons that I've been involved in. All you got to do is learn to talk in a language that people would understand you. I have a little business card. A lot of people I've given them out to, and I have a number of them with different stuff on, but there's one here I like. It tells why I swear. Because when I come in here, I couldn't say nothing. And in my home group, you will never hear a curse word. Not one. It says why I swear. One, it pleases my mother. Two, it's a fine mark of manliness. And three, it proves I have self-control. And four, it indicates how clearly my mind operates. Five, it makes my conversation so pleasing to everybody. Six, it leaves no doubt in anyone's mind as to my good breeding. Seven, it impresses people that I have more than ordinary education. Eight, it's an unmistakable sign of culture and refinement. Nine, it makes me a very, very desirable personality amongst women, children, and respectable society. And ten, it's my way of honoring God. You know, there's nothing so bad that it cannot be worse. There's nothing that time cannot mend. And troubles, no matter how many you have, must surely come to an end. You have stumbled, well, so have I in my time. Don't think of the past and regret. And you're sorry, God knows, so leave it at that. Let the past and be the past and forget. Don't despair, don't give up, but just be yourself, the self that is highest and best. And forgive all my faults, and I'll forgive yours, and we leave up to God all the rest. I'm going to leave you with a little story. And it's one that has become very dear to my heart. And it's something that we do a little bit of it in AA. It's the story of a couple in Saskatchewan, prairies in Canada. It's usually pretty cool there in the fall. They went out one evening in the fall to see their crops, and they took their little boy with them. And as little boys sometimes do, he ran off, and he got lost, and they hollered and screamed and yelled, and they couldn't find him. He went back into the house, and they phoned the Reserve Army and asked if there was any chance of sending out some troops. And he said, we'll have an officer and some troops there at daybreak. And they did. So the husband and wife took the men out to the field where they were at the night before. And the officer said, the troops line up across this field, and they did. He said, join hands, and they did. He said, head across that field, and they did. And they found the little boy, and he was dead. He perished. And he picked down, reached down, and picked his little boy up and held him in his hands. And he looked at his wife, and he said, you know, sweetheart, if we'd have held hands last night, we wouldn't have lost them. I only pray that I can be the type of friend that you've been to me. Good night and God bless you.